Welcome to Lessons I've Learned, a series of podcasts by global consultant, best-selling author, and former Harvard Business School professor, David Maister.
Hi, I'm David Maister, and this is Lessons I've Learned. This particular series is about how to develop your business through marketing, client service, and client relationships. In this sixth podcast in the series of 14, we will maintain the theme of previous podcasts by exploring how to work with clients. This particular podcast is called How to Be a Trusted Advisor. This episode is called The Trusted Advisor. It is based upon a book of the same name that I co-authored with Charlie Green and Rob Gawford. Let's start with a question. What benefits would you obtain if your clients trusted you more? Well, among the things that would happen is, first of all, they may reach for your advice more often. They may be inclined to accept and act on your recommendations. They'd bring you in on more advanced, complex strategic issues. They would treat you as you wish to be treated. They'd respect you. They'd share more information with you that would help you help them, and that would improve the quality of the services you provide. And then, of course, there'd be all sorts of marketing benefits. They'd pay your bills without question if they trusted you more. They'd refer you to their friends, and they'd hire you more often. In order to get these benefits, we have to figure out what it takes to be a trusted advisor. And we'll start by talking about your own experience. Do you have a trusted advisor? Someone you turn to regularly to advise you on all of your most important business career decisions? If you do, what are the characteristics of that person? What is it you would look for in selecting your trusting advisor? Here's my list. First of all, someone I would use as a trusted advisor is somebody who seems to understand me and likes me. Yes, that's a tough conclusion, but it's a real one. If I feel somebody doesn't like me, I may hire them for a transaction, but I'm not going to build a relationship with them. I am also going to need that they are consistent. I'm going to need to have to depend upon people if they're going to be my trusted advisor. Someone's going to be valuable to me as an advisor if they always help me see things from a fresh perspective, but don't try and force things on me. I want an advisor who's going to help me think things through. It's my decision, it is not theirs to make. I don't want them substituting their judgment for mine. There's a difference between being an expert and telling me the answer and being my advisor. What I also need in a trusted advisor is somebody who has a certain style to them. I want somebody who doesn't panic or get over emotional. I need someone who stays calm and helps me think things through and separate my logic from my emotion. Someone who knows how to criticize and correct me gently, maybe even lovingly. On the other hand, I need somebody who doesn't pull their punches. I need someone who I can rely on to tell me the truth. You probably won't be surprised to hear that the best trusted advisor I've got is my wife, Kathy. What would you add to the list I've just given of things you would look for in a trusted advisor? Once you've made that list, use the golden rule to be a guide to your actions. Because the way that we should treat others is basically the way that we wish to be treated. If you want your clients to treat you as their trusted advisor, then you must meet the same standards that you would impose on others. Ask yourself, which of these traits do my clients think I possess? Notice, you've got to ask what you think they think you possess. If you suspect that you might not demonstrate all of these traits, if they don't yet believe that you have them, then you've got to ask yourself, how do you get better at each of them? To see how your success as a professional career depends upon trust, consider your own purchases of professional services. Whether you are hiring someone to look after your legal affairs, your taxes, your child or your car, the act of retaining a professional requires you to put your affairs in somebody else's hand. You are forced into that act of faith, and you can only hope that they will deal with you appropriately. You can research their background, check their technical skills, and attempt to examine their past performance. But in spite of all of this, when the final decision on who to hire comes, you must ultimately decide who to trust with your baby. And it's never a comfortable thing to do. When retaining a professional, what you and your clients want is somebody who understands their interests and will not put their interests ahead of yours while working for you. Motives are very important here. You want someone you can trust to do the right thing. You want somebody who will care. Getting hired and getting rehired is about earning and deserving that trust. If trust is so important, how does one go about winning it? How do you get somebody to trust you? It's clear it's not done by just saying, trust me. Nothing is more likely to get the listener to put up his or her defenses. The key point is that trust must be earned and deserved. You must do something to give the other person the evidence on which they can base their decision on whether to trust you. You must be willing to give in order to get. For example, I once had to hire a lawyer to probate a relative's will. The first few lawyers I spoke with tried to win my business by telling me when their firm was founded and how many offices they had and how much they would charge. And quite honestly, none of this inspired much confidence, even though it's the normal things that most firms talk about. In fact, the more the firms talked about themselves and their business, the less interested they appeared to be in my problems. Finally, I encountered a lawyer who, in the initial phone call, asked me how much I knew about probating a will. My reply was nothing. The lawyer then offered to fax me a comprehensive outline of the steps involved, what I needed to rush to do, and what I should forget about for a while because it was not urgent. The fax also provided the phone numbers of all the government bodies I needed to notify, even though this had nothing to do with the legal work or the lawyer's fees. All of this immensely helpful information was provided for free in advance before the lawyer had been retained. This was his get hired process. Now, naturally, he cut the business. He had built confidence and earned my trust by demonstrating in the get hired process that he knew what information was most relevant to me, even though some of it had nothing to do with the actual processing of the will. He had earned trust by being generous with his knowledge and proving that he was willing to earn my business. Trust can also be earned by the simplest of gestures. I have a dentist named Andrew, who early in our relationship recommended that I permit him to perform various advanced procedures on my teeth. Like many buyers, I was not sure whether Andrew was recommending this because it was really needed or because he was just trying to increase his revenues. In other words, he was just trying to cross-sell. My view of Andrew is significantly affected by the fact that every time I and my wife Kathy go to his office, Andrew every single time telephones us that evening to ask how we're feeling. The phone will ring a little after the dinner hour, and it's Andrew saying, how do you feel, David? Has the anesthetic worn off? Do you need me to phone in a prescription to the pharmacy? And you know what? 99% of the time, everything's fine, and this should not work on me. I'm old, and I'm sophisticated, and I'm jaded, and I've been around. And you know what? It works every time. I put the phone down, and I turn to Kathy, and I go, what a nice man. And we're always very impressed by what he's done. Andrew is acting as if he's cared, which is not always usual behavior for dentists, at least not in Boston where I live. Now, of course, at first we were a little cynical. Did he actually care, or was he just acting as if he cared? Or has he been to a dental marketing course, read a marketing relations book? Initially, we didn't know. But however, over time, when Andrew's small gestures continued and accumulated, we came to believe that he was sincere. Nowadays, we usually accept his recommendations for additional work. We've come to trust him. You know, the movie The Godfather had it wrong when it said, it ain't personal, it's business. The truth of professional life is, it's business, it's personal. At its core, trust is about relationships. And I'll trust you if I believe that you're in this for the long haul, that you're not just trying to maximize the short-term benefit to you in each of our interactions. Trust is about reciprocity. You help me and I'll help you. But I need to know that I can rely on you to do your part and that our relationship is built upon shared values and principles. If I'm the client, then trusting you requires that I can believe that you'll do what you'll say you do, that your actions will match your words. And perhaps the most critical of all, I will trust you if you exhibit some form of caring. If you provide to me some evidence that my interests are as important to you as your own interests are. A common trait of trusted advisors is that the advisor places a higher value on maintaining and preserving the relationship itself than on the outcomes of the relationship, financial and otherwise. Often, the advisor will make a substantial investment in the client without a guarantee of return before the relationship does in fact generate any income, let alone on a profit. Being a trusted advisor has one more benefit which we ought to explore before moving on. If you can get to the point where working with your client is like working with a friend, conducting yourself at the office as you would outside it, you would find it an extremely valuable reward of a trusted advisor relationship. There is little pretense. Much work can be done without wasting time of words. There is no need for you or your client to posture before each other. You are who you are, as imperfect as you may be, and you do not need to allow your conflicts and incompatibilities to erode your mutual trust. Let me give you one last example from the real world about how someone has earned my trust. In my family, we do a lot of redecorating of rooms. I call it crop rotation. As soon as you finish a cycle, you start all over again. Anyway, this latest time, my wife Kathy and I were planning on redecorating a room. It was nothing major. And this latest decorator was sitting down with us, helping us to choose fabrics for the curtains, for the wallpaper, for the carpet. And at the end of the meeting, we sat and we had a cup of tea before she left. Well, after she left, a little while later, the doorbell rang. And there the decorator was, holding a window frame or a, picture frame, in which she had taken the fabrics that we had chosen, cut them approximately to the shape, the curtains, the wallpaper, and the carpet, and done just a very simple stitch so that you could see roughly what the room was going to look like when it was done. And this woman turned to Kathy, my wife, and said, "I heard you say over a cup of tea that your sister was coming in from South Carolina, about 1,000 miles from where my wife and I live. And I know, Kathy, that you would want to explain to your sister what you're planning to do with the room. So I made this for you. Hope you enjoy it. See you next week as planned." Now think about that for a minute. Don't get inspired by the story, but test it against your real world. Would that person win your business? Would you do what I did, which is go to a dinner party with friends and actually make a referral on an interior decorator, a designer? Well, I did that, and I never thought I would. Because the truth is that if you earn my trust, it is very much going to be to your business. And the way you earn my trust is act as if you cared about me. Before we leave the topic of trust, we should really try and analyze what exactly goes into making someone trust you? It clearly is complex with many factors involved. For example, you could trust someone's motives without necessarily trusting that they were very dependable, or you could trust that they were dependable without necessarily trusting their wisdom. So when we talk about overall trust, we have to examine the components. My co-authors and I, in the Trusted Advisor book, offered a simple formula as a way of beginning to think about this. The formula is very straightforward. It says that overall trust is a combination of four things: credibility, reliability, and intimacy. Trust goes up the more you have of each of those three things, divided by a fourth factor which reduces trust the more it goes up, and that is self-orientation. The more the other person seems to be in it for themselves and not trying to help you, the less you will trust them. So again, the formula is, trust is the ratio of credibility, can this person do what I want? Reliability, can I depend upon them? Intimacy, are they going to treat me like a person and not just someone in a role-to-role fashion? And then finally, divide all of that by how much do I think they are acting out of pure self-orientation. If they can do well on those four items, then the level of overall trust is likely to be high. I use the term intimacy a couple of times in that formula I have just given you, and is not meant to reflect anything particularly sophisticated. It quite simply means that when someone is working with me, I can usually tell the difference of whether or not the conversation is role to role. They are playing a purchasing agent talking to a vendor, or they are a buyer in buying mode talking to a seller who's in selling mode. That's not very intimate. We're all playing a role. The opposite is what we're calling intimacy, and that's when we just relax into both being people, that we start showing an interest in each other as human beings and talk to each other person to person. The message, I hope, is obvious, that if we can get to the point where we can talk to each other as people, person to person, then that's when trust can develop. A few more words are worthwhile on the topic of self-orientation. This doesn't just mean that the person is financially greedy. For example, it's possible that someone could lack the trust just because they're always trying to win an argument. They have a need to prevail. Let me give you an example. Sometimes when I'm giving a class or a seminar, I can get so excited about showing off my knowledge or having the fun of being the person at the front of the room that I lose sight for a short while that my main goal is to help my class understand or to improve the understanding of my audience. I have changed my focus from my self-orientation, am I being looked at well, am I having fun, from what should really be my orientation, which is am I really helping here? So I draw to your attention that what my co-authors and I have put in the formula is not only the credibility, the reliability, and the intimacy, but the final one is self-orientation, when we worry too much about ourselves and not enough about the other person. And only when we worry about the other person do they begin to trust us. I'm David Maister, and this has been Lessons I've Learned. Thanks for listening. If you found this podcast helpful, go to my website, davidmaister.com, where you'll find many other resources covering these and many other topics.